Good morning. My name is Scott Lee, and I'm an alcoholic. And grateful to be here. I'd like to say one more time, thanks to everyone who was involved. There's a lot of work that goes putting one of these things on. And I'd like to say one more time, thank you so much to everyone who worked so hard to make this possible for us. I'd like to open, as I always do, with a few moments of silence. I'm going to invite God to join us and ask him to bless me with an open heart. And I'd like to have and also I'm going to remember Bart and his dad. Serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you. We're going to talk this morning about steps 11 and 12 and some of our own observations about these things. Friend of mine said, do you know the difference between a good habit and a bad habit? And I said, no. He said, good habits are easy to break. That's been my experience. And so if I'm going to have good habits, I'm going to have to pay the price to have them. We're just getting bits and pieces here, okay? We know we can't be thorough. We don't have the time, but we're going to do what we can do. It says, interestingly enough, here on page 86, it says, on awakening, about halfway down the page. I like to observe sometimes what it does not say. It does not say, after a shower and shave, two over easy and bacon, reading the front page, a half a pot of coffee, and a fight with her. It says, on awakening. And as I said last night, that's why I bought this watch, is it has the multiple alarms. Linda and I get 10 to 20 minutes each morning, cuddling each other's arms, doing our morning prayers. It's a fabulous way to start the day, on awakening. One of my teachers says, the reason it says on awakening is because I am capable of making life-devastating decisions between the bed and the bathroom. I got to have my medicine right now. Need to take it first, and I think that's terribly important. I hear people saying that it's important for me to be comfortable in recovery, and I don't believe that. What's important is that I don't borrow pain from the past or the future. If I can reach far enough into the past or far enough into the future and find enough pain and drag it into today, I can make today so bad I can't stand it. And that's why the today word, I think, is such magic. In that paragraph, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. But before we begin, I'm going to ask God to direct my thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest or self-seeking motives. It's kind of interesting. The word divorce is a very powerful word. Divorce. What comes before divorce? Well, before divorce, way before divorce, is I'm attracted to something, and then I'm in love with it, and then it's a major part of my life, and I'm all over it, right? I don't have to be divorced from things that I never was interested in anyway. And I have to look at the truth on that, and that self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives I must be divorced from, because I was in love with them for an awfully long time. I love the language in the text. I think there's such power in some of the language. In the next paragraph, it says, we may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or decision. We relax and take it easy. That is so important that on the facing page, in the last little paragraph, it says the same thing. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated, ask for the right thought or action. A fellow in my home group took that pause when agitated, and he took the first letters, PWA, and he made them his screensaver at work. This PWA is bouncing around, and a couple of the earthlings came up behind him one day, and we call them earthlings or earth people. Anyway, the civilians came up and said, what's PWA? And he said, pause when agitated. They said, wow. They don't have their lives set on this, bet on this thing like we do. So I have to learn to pause when agitated. The short form of the steps sought through prayer and meditation, not achieved, but sought. Sought indicates that I simply took action. through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. There's an implied promise, and it implies that if I have done these first 10 steps, I will have a conscious contact, because I can't improve something I don't have. So I will have a conscious contact of some kind if I get this far. With God, as we understood Him, and my understanding continues to change. We talked about that some over breakfast. Praying only. Got into a discussion not too long ago with some very good friends of mine about individual words in the steps. And we picked out three that just scream at us. Individual words. And this is one of them. Only. That I have to get out of the business of trying to teach God or to be His coach, to tell Him what to do. And when I pray only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out, that's what that means. It means I'm not going to give Him direction anymore. I think God's will is the best deal there is. It's better than mine. The other two words that shouted us were the first word in the first step, we. I got to get out of the I business. And the third one was the word thee in the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result. Single promise we have, the result, not a, the result. Those are the ones that shouted at us. I had an experience years ago. My little business was doing pretty good, and I hired an assistant. And she was a very gentle, spiritual, Christian woman. And we're multi-line manufacturers, reps, which means we represent a lot of companies to our little territory. So I got customers on one side and factories on the other, and we stand in the middle and try to keep them from killing each other. It's kind of what the job looks like. One of the factories that we represented a little better than a third of our total income. If we lose this one, we go down the pipe the same day. There was a woman at that one that was the pricing authority, which is the person I got to have. And Sheila and I were convinced that there was a broom in their parking lot somewhere. That we figured she'd been that way since that house fell on her sister. Because something was wrong here. And she was just, and we were starting every day. Every rep I knew in the country was hating this woman. And Sheila and I were starting every day hating this woman, saying, I hope we don't have to deal with her today. God, did she hear what you, I don't know, we're doing? And one morning, it was either a Monday or Tuesday, I think it was a Monday morning, as we start our day that way at 9 o'clock, Sheila says to me, hang on a minute. You and neither one of us believe what we're doing here is the right thing. We're running this woman down, and we need to stop that. And I said, you're exactly right. And what we decided to do was something that you're going to see in the meditation workshop. I'll give a little bit more detail on it, or Linda will, when we get to that later today. But we decided to sit and send love to that woman for the first 5 minutes of our business day. We started doing that every morning. Later that week, that woman called our office to chat. We couldn't figure it out. She called our office to chat. A couple of months later, I went to Chicago to our national trade show. I walked into a room about this size with a couple hundred people in it, the hospitality suite kind of thing, which, by the way, on those things, I go late, leave early, come through the door carrying a drink. I got a schedule to call somebody in recovery while I'm there. But I do a lot of things to protect my sobriety. I treat it like it's important. I walk through the door of that thing, and this woman is elbowing people out of the way to get to me, to hug me, to tell me I'm the best rep in the country. And if she had more people like me and Sheila to deal with, her life would be so much easier. The place came to a stop. A cocktail party came to a stop, and everybody's jaw on the floor watching this. I spent the rest of that 4-day weekend with people coming up to me saying, what did you do? And I say, well, I'll tell you, but you're not going to like it. And I don't know that anything can stand up under an assault of love. I don't think anything in the negative column can. That was our experience with it. I was in my home group meeting. This has been a good 10 years ago now. And a fellow that I sponsor walked in. He had just come from his grandfather's funeral. And he said while he was there, he was studying his grandmother, and he had a thought that occurred to him. And he approached her after the funeral, and he said to her, I think you were a fabulous wife for my grandfather. And she said, I should have been. I prayed to be that every day. Yeah, it hit me hard. I began the next morning. I don't think I've missed a morning since. And I asked God to help me treasure Linda. And I use that word treasure. It's interesting. We know the word treasure is a verb, to treasure. But it's rarely used that way. Normally you hear the word treasure as a noun. I'm making a point. Within 2 weeks of starting that, nobody knew. I didn't tell a soul on earth I was doing that. Within 2 weeks of that, I happened to come out of the kitchen and walk through the den as I heard Linda say into the phone, Scott treasures me. And I think when I ask God for what he wants me to have, I get a lot of help. It's about me getting to the right question. So I ask him to help me treasure people, and I send them love. And that's just part of who I am, and that's part of what I do. Y'all talk about the next right thing. Is this something you hear a lot in meetings and from sponsors, next right thing? I've discovered for me a last right thing. And the last right thing is for me to go to bed at a reasonable hour, to set 2 alarms so that I can awaken the next morning with a full night's sleep and sufficient time to start the next day on a spiritual note with the prayer and meditation that I need to do. If I fail to do the last right thing tonight, I won't be able to do the first right thing tomorrow morning. And I frequently talk to people, say, I can't meditation in the morning, or I go to sleep in meditation all the time. And, you know, how do I stop that? Well, we're working on the symptom. The problem was the night before. So I have to keep an eye on my last right things. Go back to page 87. What used to be the hunch or occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Not suddenly, but gradually. Being still in an experience and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. I heard an old timer tell his new sponsee one time, he said, if you have a good idea, give me a call. If you have a great idea, come right over. Yeah. Yeah, let's do that page 35 thing. You want to? Let's see if we can pump some energy into this thing just for fun. There's a great question asked on page 30. We do this for fun sometimes. Great question asked on page 35 in the first full paragraph. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? That is a great question. They set it up for a whole page. And the answer to me is at the top of the following page. Top of 36, it says, yet he got drunk again. We ask him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. What did we ask for? We asked exactly what happened. What did we get? His story. Do you understand the difference between exactly what happened and his story? They're not necessarily the same. Bob is going to take the part of yet he got drunk again. I'm going to play the sponsor that he doesn't have, but what the sponsor might have said if he'd had one.
I came to work on Tuesday morning.
What happened on Monday? A lot of people work on Monday. You cut hair for a living? I mean, they get Mondays off. Okay, you came on Tuesday. Go ahead.
I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
Irritated? How about bent? How about your undies are in a permanent wad and they're starched? How about the veins on your neck throb and your face turns red every time you think about the fact that all you are is a salesman and you used to own this place and this guy that's running it now is an idiot? Irritated. You were irritated. Okay, go ahead.
I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious.
You had a fight with your boss and you don't think it's serious. Now, there is a judgment error right there. Who has ever had a fight with their boss that wasn't serious? That's how people get fired. That's how they lose jobs. That's how they get demoted. That's how their paychecks evaporate. You had a fight with your boss, and you don't think it was serious. Gee whiz. Wow, what a great vision. Go ahead, please. I can't wait to hear more.
Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car.
Well, that's where they all are. I mean, they never do show up at the lot, do they? I mean, you just, what, are you going to knock on a few doors? Or maybe they're down by the river. Have you got your fishing gear in the trunk? See, that just makes perfect sense to me. All right. So here we have a series of his story as opposed to what happened that leads us to another thought very similar to that in the italics at the bottom of the page.
Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
There it is. I believe if this guy had had a sponsor who had responded similarly to what I did, we might not have gotten to the ounce of whiskey in the milk. I need help with my thinking. And I think that's one of the best advertisements for sponsorship that we've got. Is that little blurb right there. Let's go back to 86 for just a minute. I'm going to turn it over to Bob. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Okay, so once again, I do not have permission to beat myself up over mistakes. Constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? There's that list again. Did self reemerge? Is really the question. Oh, an apology? Kept something to ourselves, should be discussed with another person at once. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Were we thinking what we could do for others, what we could pack into the stream of life? Isn't that interesting? Bob said this. I get a lot of great stuff from him. I think you can see why. He said, if you want something for yourself, go give it to someone else. And that generalized a long time ago. It got specific for me last night. And I've got a couple of guys I sponsor I can't wait to take that to. They're having some problems with some people. And they don't seem to be able to resolve. And I'm going to ask them to go look for things to compliment these people on. Let's go look for good things in these people. Let's see how that changes. Let's send them love like we've been doing, but let's see what we can pack into the stream of their life. Gee, that's a nice looking tie. Boy, you know, you did a great job on that, or you've got a great telephone voice. There is something nice I can say to that person, and it needs to be true. I'm going to search for it, and it will change. Pack into the stream of life. What can I give? I'm going to tell you a couple of things that I do sometimes. I don't know if they do it here. Down south, if you find a penny on the ground, if it's heads up, it's a lucky penny. What do you do if it's tails? Bend down and turn it over and leave it for somebody else to find a lucky penny. Do something for someone and don't get caught. That really good parking place you found in Rio real close when it was raining, don't take it. Pass that and leave that for someone you'll never know. Your legs are in good shape. That rain isn't going to hurt you. Go park further out. See what happens to you when you take that level of, when I take that level of service into a day. I had one a couple of days ago. I hope I can remember it for a long time. I had one of those days where I was just blessed that my morning, I can't judge my relationship with God by how I feel. I learned that years ago. But I like it when I feel close. And I had one of those feel close days, and my morning meditation was great. And I was literally seeking chances to be of service. And I started out and found some early in the day. And you just can't believe the way the skies opened up and neat stuff fell on me all day long. I found some of the most fantastic, friendly, fun people to play with all day long. And it was because that's what I was looking for. And that's who I was being, was trying to be somebody of service. Pray about it is what I do. And just look for ways to be of service. I'm going to stay here. We must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Okay, once again, I can't beat myself because it would diminish our usefulness to others. There we are back on the usefulness to others thing. I say we found 60, I think it's 62 is our current count. And then after making our review, here's a prayer. We ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. I like to take those to my sponsor or spiritual advisor. It's under the if you have a good idea, if you have a great idea category. I got to be careful. I'm capable of making amends that do more damage than the amend. I'm capable of making an amend that gets me off the hook that hurts them. I've done that. I have to be real careful that I don't get involved in that again. I think that's it for me.
Thank you.
Why don't you take it?
Bob, good morning. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
I want to thank you all for sitting and listening to us prattle on about our experience this weekend.
Yeah, I think we improved it up to prattle.
I was confused about step 11. Of course, I was confused about 8 and 9 and 6 and 7 and 4 and 5 and 1 and 2 and 3. And I don't follow directions well. Smart guys don't have to. And I didn't get sober at a time. There was when I got sober in the 70s in Las Vegas, there was no one that in Vegas that could take you through the big book. Yeah. So I was kind of out there on a limb, and I had a bad case of alcoholism. I'd relapsed for 7 years. So I listened to tapes. I talked to people. I studied the book. I tried to sponsor other people. And I'd started doing something that nobody had ever done. I started taking guys through the book, a book I don't even really know. And it's funny how you start learning the book when you're trying to give it to somebody else. The Hindus say the student doesn't learn the lesson until he becomes the teacher. And I, that's sort of how I found myself and found this process in this book, by trying to give it away. And I didn't even understand what I was trying to give away. But it, I got clarity as I started. Something, because what would happen is I was caring about this guy that I'm trying to help, I'm out of the way, God moves in, it all clicks. It starts to click. But well, here's some of the things that were difficult for me. And my ego heard about meditation from day one, right? Like, because my ego gets alert when it hears about stuff like, oh, there might be power there for me. Right? Oh, this is the step where I rise above the little people. Oh, yeah, meditation. I like this. Wonder what, should I wear a white robe or a red one?
White, I think.
White. Mm-hmm. So I started to read and figure out this part of the book, okay? So I come to the bottom of page 85, and it starts a section on step 11. You know how you know that? Because in italics it says step 11. It says step 11 suggests prayer meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works. Oh, good, it works. If we have the proper attitude and work at it, it would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Okay, I'm ready. Buckle in. I'm going to get some definite and valuable suggestions about step 11 about prayer meditation. And here's what it says. It says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? I'm reading this thinking, man, that ain't right. That ain't right. That's inventory. What's that doing here? Is that a misprint? Should that have been on the previous page? And I read further on down the page, and there's nothing in this from here to the end of the chapter that looks like meditation. There's a couple prayers. There's the we ask God to direct our thinking. Then again, we ask God for inspiration. We ask especially for freedom from self-will. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others are helped. There's some prayers, but nothing that looks like meditation. And I know about meditation because I'm a smart guy. Smart guys know stuff, right? I went to TM. I had a mantra, for God's sakes. Don't tell me about meditation. I chanted in Namne Yoho Renge Kyo with the Buddhists, with SGI. I've done it all. I've done different types of yoga. And this doesn't match up with my preconceived notion of what it should be. And smart guys, consequently, can't at times observe, read, or listen to hear anything new. We can only look to see how we're already right. And so, consequently, I never took the direction on these couple pages. And what I did was a thing that a lot of people do. I started seeking other vehicles of meditation. And over the years, I did just about everything you could think of. For my first 17, probably, years of sobriety, I started doing the out of the 12x12, the prayer of St. Francis, good prayer. Then I found another version of it I like better, the one that says, instead of a channel, make me an instrument. I like that even better. I got to the end of that rope, where that was just seemed to be shallow after a while. And I thought, you know, I'll go to church. And I went to a couple churches. And I said the rosary for a while. Just, I thought, well, hey, what the heck? You know, it's very, the Muslims do the beads. The Catholics do the beads. Maybe there's something in beads, right? The hippies did the beads. I had beads when I was a hippie, right? Now we'll do the beads. I went back to the Buddhists for a while. I like Buddhism. Started reading all kinds of spiritual literature. I did a meditation. I found a meditation that I sometimes use to this day. It's called I Am the Place, and it's a very centering thing. I am the place where God shines through. Him and I are one, not two. I need not worry, fret, or plan. He wants me where and as I am, and if I be relaxed and free, he carries out his plan through me. Used that for a long time, still use that sometimes today. I did all this stuff, and it's all good. The book says it's all good. At the bottom of page 87, the bottom of the last full paragraph, it says, be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they have to offer. There's a whole world out there full of stuff. In addition to, not in substitution for. And that was the mistake I made. I never did what it talks about on page 86 and 87. And consequently, when I was about 17 or 18 years sober, I guess, somewhere in there. I know it was after 15 and not 20. A guy that I sponsor came up to me, and he was sober over 10 years. He was sober a long time, and he's asking me pointedly for concrete direction on what to do in step 11. Well, the problem is that I don't have a home run for him. I've done so many things that I don't really know what to tell him. Because there's nothing as definitive. I mean, it's all good, but there's not one thing where I can say, oh, this is it. And I don't get what to tell him. So there's a fallback position sponsors use. And if your sponsors use this, it's usually because he doesn't know. You say, well, do what it says in the book, you know, because I don't really know what to tell him. Well, that SOB actually started doing what it said in the book, and in no time at all, he was doing better than I was. I don't like that. That's not good. And what is happening to him is he's reaping the emotional balance that occurs when you've pushed yourself out of the way and you're better carrying out the decision you made in step 3, which is the point of step 11 and 12, and 10, 11, and 12. It's not to hone myself into such a state of spiritual perfection I glow in the dark, right? The ego wants to use meditation to be up here. The way the book's designed, it's to bring me right here, right with you where my fellow travelers are, so I can maximize my usefulness. Remember in step 3, we took a stance of self-abandonment. When I said to my father, I said, here, take me for you to build with me and you to do with me as you will. I don't get a vote. I'm advocating my opinion, my judgment, whatever. I'll take whatever you give me. I'm out of the this is good, this is bad business. That's the position I'm trying to take now. I'm asking him to relieve me of the bondage of self because I can't, it's hard for me to take that kind of position. And I'm doing all of that not for my own self-enhancement. I'm doing that all for one reason and one reason only, so that victory over these difficulties with the bondage of self would put me in a position where I can bear witness to those I'm going to help of his power, his love, and his way of life. It is all to put me in a position to help others, period. It's not for self-enhancement. There's nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that's self-grandizing, self. Matter of fact, we're moving away from self. We're moving away. That's the point. And when I started doing this, a couple things occurred. One was I found a little tiny passage in step 11 in the 12x12, where all of a sudden I knew why the first paragraph on the top of 86 was about inventory or self-examination. In the 12x12, it says that self-examination, meditation, and prayer, when taken separately, can bring about much benefit and relief. And that's true. But I'm not in the relief business. I've spent my whole life as a relief junkie. I'm looking for something more important. I'm looking for something that is, if I don't find it, I will die. I'm looking for freedom from the bondage of self. The book says if we don't get over this, if we don't get free of this selfishness, we must or it kills us. I have to find this freedom from the bondage of self. And I have to grow in understanding and effectiveness and fitting myself to be a maximum service to God's kids. And so that's the point. And it says, even though these things taken separately can bring much benefit and relief, it said when they're logically related and interwoven, as they are on page 86 and 87, they create an unshakable foundation for life. The reason that self-examination, this inventory paragraph on page 86, which actually is more detailed than the inventory in step 10 on the previous pages, it's actually more specific. And the reason it's there is it's supposed to be. We're not supposed to separate prayer, meditation, and self-examination. They're a package, an interacting package. Very similar to what a sailor will use. If you were to go down here to the harbor, say on somewhere wherever there's a harbor on the island or wherever the big ships are, the boats are, and you were to rent or buy the finest sailboat money could buy. I mean, no, you spared no expense. You got the absolute best piece of equipment there was. And you decided, as we decide in step 3, to move towards a life of self-abandonment and service, only you decide your goal is the island of Bermuda. And you go to the nautical library and you diligently study the first step, 9 steps of navigation, and you plot a perfect course for the island of Bermuda. Perfect. Right on the money, man. And you set out of that harbor and you're right for Bermuda. It doesn't matter how great your boat is. It doesn't matter how perfect your course is. Every single day, the winds and the tides and the currents are going to move you off course. It's not because you have a bad boat. It's not because you played with your tiller too much. It's just the way it is. And if you're a sailor, you must take an examination of where you are every single day so that you can realign yourself to the destination every day. So tomorrow you're going to find yourself off course again. Of course you are. The clamoring of self is constant, it's consistent, and it's ever present. It is as present as God. It never goes away. So that I can reset my course back to the destination, to fall off, to reset. That's why this is a chronic spiritual malady rather than an acute spiritual. If it was an acute spiritual malady, I'd never leave the course for Bermuda. I'd just realize I was over here, I'd go like that, and I'd just stay there. But chronic means it's constant, constant readjustment, constant readjustment. And we see people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are deluded by the clamoring of the ego that we've arrived, we're good to go now, we're comfortable, we don't have to keep doing this. Ah, my sponsor, he's not really that bright. You know, this service thing, God, I've done a lot of that, for God's sakes. Is there no end to my goodness? Don't really need to do that as much. We start compromising. Step 10 and 11, I mean, if I ever was wrong, I would admit it. But the chances are slim now. And what happens is we get re-inundated by self again, and we don't know it. Because the ego says, oh, you're so spiritual. You know, the ego tells me that I got the deal. Right? Because that's what the clamoring of self always does that. And then what happens is I start to get further away from the destination and further back into self. And then I've seen this 100 times. I used to go to a noon meeting every day in Las Vegas where it was what Scott calls an open, disgusting meeting, where they start the meeting out with, does anybody have a problem? Which is, like, where did that come from? I mean, how did that get into AA?
I don't know.
This is a room full of people who can't manage their own life. I think I need advice from them. Oh.
On relationships.
On relationships.
Which they're also good at.
So every once in a while, at this noon meeting, I would see someone run to the meeting in crisis, extreme crisis, because they've been out there on a limb building a structure, a house of cards out of self, business, big money, house, marriage, kids, prestige, property, power, or at least the illusion of it. And then all of a sudden, something happens. The ego, there's no problem as long as the ego is getting its way. And then all of a sudden, something happens. Maybe they catch their wife sleeping with someone else. Maybe the IRS starts taking stuff from them. Maybe they get busted because they got some little devious little self-gratification thing going over here, and they have it hidden in the closet, and they get arrested for it. Something happens, and all of a sudden, the house of cards starts to collapse, and now they're in panic crisis mode, and they run to the meeting, and the chairman says, "Does anybody have a problem?" And they just raise their hand, and they dump this garbage on the meeting looking to be fixed and looking for advice. Well, I'll tell you something. You can't get advice in an AA meeting. It's like trying to take a drink of water out of a fire hose. Everybody in the meeting immediately starts sharing at them. And I've seen this a dozen times. Inevitably, halfway through the meeting, they can't take it anymore. They'll get up and bolt out of the meeting and leave the meeting spinning on their problem. Now, they've just took a whole room full of people hostage. They've left, and they're still hostage, right? And who got helped out of that?
Nobody
got helped. Matter of fact, that we lose some of those, that guy bolted out of there because he wasn't getting the relief he was seeking here. Chances are he went to a bar, a dope man's house, maybe a psychiatrist to get some medication. Maybe he went out and gambled. Maybe he went out and picked up a hooker. But the clamoring of self was, and the need for some kind of self-gratification, self-enhancement, self-relief was so intense. Because you can get so far out there that you can't – I think you can get beyond God's grace. Now, that sounds weird, but I think it's possible for me to get so entrenched in self there's no room for anything else. The ego has the capacity, if I fill up with me completely, to blocking anything else from coming in there. That's why most of us – you look at alcoholics dying of alcoholism. I mean, why don't they get help? You can't until you're broken. You can't. Until the ego has been reduced just enough to allow a little bit of help to come in, a little bit of light, right? These guys, we lose these guys. And the alcoholic mind and the ego will always justify itself. So you think you're on the going to the Bermuda on the boat, and you start seeing chunks of ice floating by with penguins on them. Now you have to explain to yourself, do you know they have penguins on Bermuda? They really do. You know, it's a new thing they got now. It's
yeah, they're on a geographical
curve.
They're on a, right.
Yeah. They've How often we justify? We start telling you got to tell yourself that little story about how this isn't wrong. This is fine, right? And we get so far out there, we can't get back. One of the questions daily that I love, and it always kind of, sometimes it kind of sticks in my craw a little bit. It says, were we kind and loving towards all? All? I'm kind and loving to the ones that deserve kind and loving. I'm kind and loving to the ones that are kind and loving to me. But the book doesn't say that. It says all. If I'm serious about the decision in step three, then I have advocated and given up my judgment of who deserves service. The ultimate spiritual path is service without prejudice. Can you help the ones you don't like? Can you be loving and kind towards the ones that ain't doing it right? What about the, can you be loving and kind towards the people in AA that don't have much of a program? Can you be kind and loving towards all? This is a big deal. This is a stretch for guys like me. I love this middle of page 87 where it talks about, we ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful, caution, we are careful to make no request for ourselves only. That word only in step 11 is so important, because anything other than that is I'm back in playing God again. As a result of the spiritual awakening in the steps, I went back and revisited not only my religion, but a lot of religions. And one of the things I realized and that came to me in looking back at the Ten Commandments, which is the basis of all Judo-Christian theology, is in the second commandment, I think I misinterpreted that. And I think that my teachers as a kid misinterpreted it to me. When they said that the second commandment, for those of you who don't know what it is, it says, I shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. That I thought, I was told and educated to believe that that meant I'm not supposed to cuss. And not cussing is a cool deal, because it offends some people. And it often is a vehicle for resentment and hostility and anger, which pushes people away and makes them uncomfortable. But I think, objectively, what would be the vainest use I could use of God's name? Wouldn't it be to pray for my will? I mean, could you get any more vain than that? I am going to instruct the creator of the universe. I mean, objectively, is there anything vainer than that? Right? God, I know you have it all together here, but this guy's cancer, God. Hey, what are you thinking? Hey, come on. Huh? My kid's on drugs, God. Hey, come on. It's time to step up. Chuck Chamberlain, I heard him say something back about 1980, and I didn't get it for a long time, and I think it's one of the most brilliant things I've ever heard. He said that he thought we did ourselves a disservice when we said, let go and let God. He said, let God do what? I don't have to ask God for anything. He's already given it to me. It's already in place. He said that he believed God's gift was the foundation of creation. It was already there. The problem is I'm just asleep to it. I just don't get it. What if... Imagine, right this moment, every problem and thing in your life that you find objectionable and needs to be fixed, what if it's already fixed? What if it was perfect as is? What if the problem isn't really what's going on? The problem is your ego's judgment of it that is making you crazy. I had a guy come up to me. He was sober over 20 years, and he had just gone through a period of, I think, about almost 2 weeks, I guess, or over a week of insanity, because he had this big deal going on and it wasn't going his way, and there was a lot of money and a lot of stuff involved, and it was going south, and he had a lot of self-centered fear, and it just wore him out. You know how that worrying deal can wear you out? You can just sit in a chair and get tired. You know what I mean? Just grinding away at stuff. He was worn out. And he finally got through of it and saw some light at the end of the tunnel and started to relax a little bit. And it was... And we're talking about it. And I said, that was a tough... He's telling me it was a tough week. I said, tough week, wasn't it? Yeah, it was a tough week. He said, that's really a horrible feeling, that fear and anxiety of not getting your way. He said, man, I'm telling you. He says, I hate that. I said, you know, you're sober over 20 years now. I think maybe you're ready for the secret. Secret? What secret? I said, well, I can, if you're ready for it, I can tell you exactly how you will never again experience that awful anxiety of not getting your own way. And he says, really? I said, yeah. He says, what? Very simple. Don't have a way. And he went, oh, that wouldn't work. Don't have a way. Isn't that really what we're trying to do, is not have a way? That's the essence of the decision I made in step three. Don't have a way. Maybe it's all perfect right now. I'm just asleep, daydreaming over the clamoring of my ego that's going, well, this ain't right. Oh, that ain't no good. Oh, there's a problem over here. That's not really a problem, but it could be one day. I better watch it very closely. And the clamoring of the ego. Did you ever have this happen to you? You walk into your home group where you're the most connected, where the people you love probably more than anywhere else, where there's a group of people. You walk in there, and it's like a key turns in your head, and you just sit there and you start noticing stuff. Why is she walking across the room in the middle of the meeting? Doesn't she get enough attention? What is he cross-talking? What is he talking? Doesn't he listen? Did you see that guy had 4 cups of coffee and didn't put any money in the basket? Did you hear what he shared? He sounds like a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore. Who's he trying to impress? And what happened? As the ego rose up, right? The ego rose up. It is the source of my separation. It is the thing that blocks me from God and from everything that God would do and work in my life. I suspect that practicing the presence of God is more about practicing the absence of self. There's an old American Indian story about this young brave who goes to the old shaman in the tribe, and he says to the old man, old man, I have a problem. He says, I don't understand what goes on with me, but some days I feel a sense of community with the tribe. I run with the braves. I help the old women. I feel the presence of the Great Spirit. And then other days I'm resentful. I just notice what's wrong with everybody. I want to be left alone. I don't want to be bothered with these people. And I don't understand it. And the old man says, well, son, your life is like 2 dogs trapped within a sack in mortal combat to the death. One dog representing self and the other dog representing the Great Spirit. And the young brave says, well, which one wins? And the old man says, the one you feed. The inherent problem in chronic spiritual malady of alcoholism is that I always, on first inclination, will feed the wrong dog. It's not because I'm stupid. It's not because I'm a bad guy. It's just the natural course of having this sickness or illness of my spirit. My sponsor calls it a disease of perception. When I am really in a bad spot spiritually, going to the detox and spending 2 hours with a guy who's coming off a drunk who's in really bad shape does not seem as interesting as buying a new car or going where I'm going to get some pats on the back. The clamoring of self is for self-grandizement. It's for self-gratification. It's for self, 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 self. And yet we all know that doesn't work. Because no matter what the juice is, the pump we get from that gratification of ego, it's almost as if my spirit and my self or ego are on a teeter-totter, diametrically opposed to each other. And when I am in good spiritual shape, I've been maintaining my spiritual condition, my ego is down and my spirit is up. And on those days, everything's good. On those days, I'm not a judgmental guy. On those days, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I see myself in all of you. I feel a sense of community. We're all in the same boat here. Not perfect, but we're all doing, really doing good. I feel close to you. I don't need any props. I don't need any attention. How I look is how I look. It's all good. There's just the perfect rightness. I have received and am holding the gift of God, which as it is now. When I'm not maintaining my spiritual condition, the ego is able to rise up to compensate for the vacancy in my heart. And at that time, that's when I start noticing what's wrong with people. That's when I'm the most judgmental, as if the ego wants to tear you down to grandize me. That's why gossip. I know people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are addicted to gossip. It's one of the number one tools of the ego. Because when you're telling someone information about someone else, there's an illusion of power. I got the knowledge. I got the juice. I am somebody because I know about this person. You need to hear what I got the power here. It's the good dope syndrome. I got the good stuff here. Sometimes people do that with the big book. They study the big book diligently because I got the good stuff here. But the big book is not the power. The big book's the roadmap to the power. This is not a 12-step, new age 12-step religion. It's a process designed to push me out of the way. And when that happens, God shows up. It's like those holograms that you look at, and you look at, and they look like Rorschachs. You can't see what they are. And then all of a sudden, when you're out of the way, it's just all of a sudden. When you've practiced the absence of self, the presence of God materializes. He just shows up. And that's why there's not a lot of information in Alcoholics Anonymous about God, but there's a whole lot of information in here about getting free of self. Chuck Chamberlain used to say, God deplores a vacuum. You get out of the way, you don't have to find God. Just get out of the way. He'll show up. He'll show up in your life. That's why the 12th step is so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the primary vehicle to relieve us of the bondage of self. Primary. Without it, there's not enough meditation, and there's not enough prayer, and there's not enough spiritual literature to overcome self. Without certain other-centered versus self-centered actions. It's the only thing left. It's the spiritual default position is to help others. On the bottom of page 87, there's a line here that I, very bottom of the page is, I was sober. I'm embarrassed to tell you how long I was sober when I got this line, but it was a long time. And I'm reading it one day, and it says, we constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. And I thought, well, God, why would they say constantly? And it was like a light when I thought, oh, my God, because I'm constantly trying to run the show. I'm constantly falling back to the I know guy, falling back to the gratification of the ego, the trying to get my way. It's my default. It's the illness's default position. And that's why I must constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show. I think the ego gets smart. You know, it's like it starts taking spiritual principles. It starts taking stuff out of the big book. It doesn't care what it uses in order to make it superior, and it doesn't care. So the clamorings of self are endless. Endless.
I got a couple more pieces.
Okay, why don't you go?
Let me go?
Yeah.
Okay. Just a couple of thoughts here. This is a gift from one of our teachers, a fellow named Sandy, some of you have probably heard.
He and I talked about it one time, and he said, the measure of my recovery is not whether or not I get off the path. We all do. The measure is how quickly I get back on. And I think that's what step 10 and 11 are about this constant course correction he was talking about. This is one from Bob, and I haven't heard him say it this weekend. He knocked me down with it a couple of months ago when we were doing one of these. He said, if you want to get free of your past, make it useful. When we talk about that thing on page 124 about each family that's been relieved, those who have not, when I'm willing to share that past, those things, and show how I was given help, not how I overcame, but how I was given help. That's part of how I get free of it. I quit when I was sober 2 years. I stopped praying for God's guidance. I had been doing it diligently, and I went to a new level. I talked about not closing my mind on spiritual concepts. And what occurred to me was that God was this loving, gentle God was sending the guidance every day. I was asking for what had already been given. What I ask now is that I might be open to the guidance. All the blocks and if you're praying for guidance, I think it's a wonderful idea. But all the blocks in the channel between me and God are at my end. Right? His end's clear, right?
Right.
Right. So the work kind of needs to be done on my end. And you didn't do the thing about the Beatles and all of that. We got time. I'm going to do one more quick one here. This is just something that occurred to me one time, and I wrote it down. I have a cup and I have a crock, and every day one of them runneth over. And on the days when I'm out trying to have my will and get it my way, it tends to be the crock. And on the days when I'm trying to figure out a way to be of service, it tends to be the cup. And I get to choose every day. Tell me about the Beatles.
Beatles and the change in the meditation, the meaning.
Oh.
You started on that. Oh, you got lost. You ad-libbed.
Oh, yeah.
They usually put an adult with him, but I'm all that's available today, so.
About the time that my sponsee starts following the directions in there, we found a dictionary from 1913, and we looked up the definition of the word meditation, and it became very apparent that the definition of the word meditation changed in the English language in the 60s. With the Beatles and J. Krishnamurti, Alan Watts, Timothy Leary, Aldous Huxley, the Maharishi, all these people bring from Eastern civilization or Eastern culture bringing over these spiritual techniques, all of a sudden the word meditation changed. When they wrote this book in 1939, when they said meditation, they were talking about something different than what we think of today. That's why a lot of this didn't make sense to me, and I didn't follow the directions. The example it used, it's so perfect. The example it used in the dictionary was a general will meditate a war. Now, I could picture a general rising up in the morning before a horrible battle. Only his battle was with an enemy, ours is with self. And it says, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. I could picture the general thinking about the battle. It says, we consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains and this army to use. And he calls his officers in, and he says, these horses are lame. We have to pull them out of the army today. These soldiers are wounded, man. They can't march with us. Those cannons are warped. Those guns won't fire. Only in our case, we're looking at aspects of self, because they didn't work yesterday, they didn't work the day before, and they ain't going to work today. And we're asking God to pull them out of the fray today. And all of a sudden, this whole thing started to make perfect sense. It's that I approach the day with a meditative stance on getting back to course of this decision I made in step 3 of self-abandonment and service. It's where it has to be the default position, because if I don't If I don't put action to bring myself back to that, I automatically go back to me. And that's why it says on awakening. I don't know about you guys. When I wake up, first thing I think about is me, pretty much. Just me. Wonder. I wake up wondering about me and worrying about me. And if I'm worrying about you, it usually has to do with me. Scott?
Tell a very quick story, and we'll take a break. I sit and meditate almost every morning, and I'm not one of those guys that gets these visions, but every once in a while I get one. I sponsored a guy. I still sponsor him. He's got 22 years. He's the first one that I sponsored that lived, and that made it. And he and I fished a lot his first year, and in this meditation I could see us out on this magnificent Buffalo River. I'll talk about in this next session. And I'm in the back of the canoe, he's in the front, we're fishing this beautiful water. And in my meditation, I could see this. And what the Buddhists call my monkey mind started talking to me and said, well, you jerk. It was worse than that. That here you are out on the river playing with Ron. He had about 6 months at that time. And you're supposed to be trying to get close to God. And this, what I've heard called the still small voice, this gentle voice spoke. And I heard it in my solar plexus. And it said, if you want to get close to me, work with my people. And it startled me out of meditation, and because I knew I just heard the master's voice, and I really took that in. And for about my spiritual arrogance knows no bounds. For the next couple of years, I worked out hard, knowing that what that meant was for me to help the people that weren't as far down the path as I was. It took me 2 years to realize it might mean for me to work with those that were much further than I was, so that I could continue to learn. And that has turned out to be one of the great truths for me. When I want to get close to God, I work with his people. And it doesn't matter whether they're my teachers or whether I'm in the teacher. It doesn't matter. It's when I work with his people, I get the closeness. We're going to take about a 13-minute break. We're going to start at quarter of. This next session is my favorite of all that we do.